Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email and phone. And I'll be giving out those phone numbers in just a few moments, but before I do so, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for professional consultation. Now, a few weeks ago, I attended the Institute for Functional Medicine's International Conference, which always is provocative and interesting, and I had promised that I would bring you back an update on the microbiome and probiotics, and so that's where we're going to start today. And I want to throw out a very provocative way of thinking about this, just a sort of a game changer. Perspective, as you know, makes a big difference on how you see a situation. So what if we framed the possibility that a group of bacteria 3.5 billion years ago essentially began evolving or co-evolving into first large mats of bacteria and eventually into eukaryotic cells with mitochondria, which are actually little bacteria swimming around in larger bacteria. And eventually those eukaryotic cells became multicellular organisms and developed intestines, which were promptly infested with archaeobacteria. What if bacteria essentially evolved humans as the perfect habitat for themselves, a mobile animal that would carry them around and provide them with food? Well, what's in support of thinking about it that way? Well, here's one. The cell density of archaeobacteria in the human colon are the highest on the planet. If you are an ancient bacteria, an anaerobe that needs protection from oxygen that pesky algae started making, well, the inside of the human gut is obviously the best possible environment on the planet. Further support of that is that all mammals have unique bacterial microbiomes that are co-evolved with them. And at this point, we can't survive without our gut bacteria. They're fundamental to our nutrition. They process a large number of the foods we eat and create some of the vitamins that we need to survive. So it's a co-evolution. And when you start thinking about it this way, then it really, really starts to get interesting. There are footprints for specific diseases that we are now beginning to see. People with diabetes show reduced populations of bifidobacteria. People with obesity have low ratios of Bacteroides to Firmicutes species, and these are anaerobes. People with atherosclerosis, that's been linked to low levels of Bacteroides and high levels of something called Ruminococcus. Irritable bowel syndrome patients typically have low levels of the protective bifidobacterium, and people with inflammatory bowel disease have high levels of Enterobacter, but low levels of Firmicutes prausnitzii, possibly because that is protective. It's Firmicutes fecobacterium prausnitzii. These names get kind of crazy on you, and they get abbreviated often, so colorectal cancer associated with low levels of Bacteroides. Now, where's the cause and effect here? Well, we have a plausible mechanism. That's always important when you're talking about cause and effect. And it has to do with communication. The bacteria talk to our bodies and they influence all sorts of things. For example, there's a bacteria, a desirable one called Acromantia munificifilia. You won't find this on any bottle of probiotics that you buy in the store. Here's why. It's an anaerobe. We have problems culturing anaerobes in our usual manufacturing methods because oxygen is toxic to them. Acromantia munificifilia is called mucinophilia because it promotes mucin, which is mucus, which protects our intestines from viruses and other bacteria. It improves gut integrity. And if there's one take-home lesson I brought back from this conference, it's that probiotics are all well and good, and I absolutely still advocate their use, particularly when you're trying to rehabilitate an intestine that's already damaged, or when you're giving antibiotics and you know you're going to be disrupting the environment. The antibiotics, the probiotics that we can give are like a Band-Aid that protects the gut from the most severe effects of antibiotics, which include Clostridium difficile, a real troublemaker that once it gets going can devastate the intestine. More about C. difficile in a moment. But the take-home lesson that I bring to you today is about prebiotics. In other words, if you want a healthy microbiome, you need to eat the food that will grow these anaerobic bacteria that modulate your immune system, that protect you from heart disease, that protect you from diabetes and colon cancer and Crohn's disease and other inflammatory bowel disease. You need to grow these folks by eating their food. So for example, if you want to promote Acromantia mucinophilia, two things that work really well are kale smoothies and capsaicin. That's right, hot pepper, capsaicin. Other things that promote the fecal bacterium that we like, that Prausenitzii that's associated with a lot of improvement in gut integrity. Well, let me give you a list. Chicory root, leeks, yams, onions, garlic. I like onions and garlics and leeks because they also supply sulfur, which helps with detoxification. Garbanzo beans and chickpeas are particularly good. Jicama, fennel, Jerusalem artichoke, and a recipe for gut healing. If you have an ulcerated gut, ulcerative colitis, other inflammatory bowel disease, simple, cheap, easy, cooked apples and cinnamon. The cinnamon is a strong anti-inflammatory inhibitor, directly inhibits the COX enzymes, and the apples provide lots of available substrate for your probiotics. So that old adage, an apple a day keeps the doctor away, turns out to be absolutely true. And the mechanism for that is by providing fuel and fodder for your herd of good bacteria. So maintaining a healthy gut microbiome is hugely protective. And we're beginning to start to see what we need to watch for. There's a bacteria called Verrucomicrobia. It goes up in people with C. difficile, and it may be a predictive factor for Crohn's disease. If you look in people with Crohn's disease, when they're before they flare, you see an uptick in the Verrucomicrobia. This is a inflammatory bacterium that sets off the immune system. Another connection for C. difficile, which is the infection that people get after taking strong antibiotics, is that C. difficile eats bile acids. One of its substrates is our major bile acid. But the good bacteria ferment our bile acids, and it turns out that fermented bile acid actually inhibits the growth of C. difficile. Well, sure, this provides ample opportunity to develop a pharmaceutical that would mimic the fermented bile acid and inhibit C. difficile, but wouldn't it be better to just have those protective bacteria present and healthy and abundant? And, you know, the numbers are really, really staggering when we start to think about our microbiome. And by the way, it's not just the bacteria in your gut. There are 1 trillion bacteria on your skin, 10 billion bacteria in your mouth. 10 minutes of kissing, by the way, folks, transfers 80 million bacteria, and many of those take up permanent residence in the mouth. If you think in terms of genes, the number of bacterial genes to human genes walking around right now in that in your on and in your skin is 150 to 1. And the key thing about bacteria is they trade genes through things called bacteriophages. So they trade genes all the time. And that means that they get genes from food. Now, here's something really interesting. A recent study showed that Japanese people who eat a high seaweed diet actually get genes from the marine bacteria that are on the seaweed. Those genes are incorporated into the intestines of the Japanese people and allow them to make enzymes that break down seaweed. So we have an established mechanism for our food to actually transfer genetic information into our bodies. That is new information and really interesting. And it also makes me feel even strongly more negative about GMO foods. Because if we have established the principle that bacteria can trade genes, including disease resistance genes and antibiotic resistance genes, and we have established that bacteria can talk to our immune systems, then when we put genes into food, we are potentially putting those genes into those bacteria and thence into our own bodies. And in fact, some of the components in genetically modified foods have been picked up in human cord blood. So do we really want to do that kind of gene therapy on ourselves? We really, really need to get that stuff labeled. This needs to be a major national movement. Diet alters your microbiome within 48 hours. When you change what you eat, you change what's growing inside you very, very rapidly. And contaminated food, the bacteria that's on dirty food, may actually be useful. So maybe we need a little bit of that bacteria. And because our industrial food chain goes very far out of its way to get rid of bacteria to improve the shelf life of food, we may, in fact, between that and the antibiotics coming through in our diet, even if we avoid antibiotics in terms of our own treatment with medicine, if we are not eating only organic meats and dairy, we are getting some antibiotics inadvertently into our system. We may be drastically altering our microbiome. And I want to put in a final word. Back at the turn of the 20th century, when we went from 1800 to 1900, there was a great deal of talk about fiber and cereal. And, you know, that was something that we kind of poo-pooed in the middle of the 20th century. But the average primitive person, which is the gut that we evolved, consumes something like 10 times the amount of fiber in a day that we do with our processed food diet. And that fiber, as I've just promoted, that's the prebiotics. That's the food for the bacteria. So we reduce the variety of bacteria in our intestines when we reduce the quantity of fiber. And we all need to move back to higher fiber diets, and particularly these prebiotic compounds that I've been talking about in the last 5 minutes. So let's take a deep breath and imagine a world where we manipulate our intestines to promote a healthy microbiome, and how many diseases we might be able to mitigate or modulate, like allergies, like irritable bowel, inflammatory bowel. I believe that we are entering a new age of medicine because of our genomic tools. And I'll be talking about that more and more over the next few weeks. And we're going to go to Gary in Hilo, Hawaii. Hello, Gary.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning. You're on the air. Hello.
Oh, wonderful. Good. Dr. Don, I have osteoporosis, and I really don't like taking the Fortio and Prolia that my doctors has recommended. I tried Fortio once, and for a week I felt I was constipated and very tired. I felt awful. I took it every day, and now every day for a week, and now the doctor wants me to take it every other day or every third day or every fourth day just to get it in my system to build up the my bone, because I do have right now severe, very painful sciatica, which is related, I think, to the sciatic nerve coming out of the spinal.
Do you have compression fractures?
I do.
Okay. So when the vertebrae collapse, they definitely can pinch the nerves. So it's very plausible that that's where your sciatica is coming from. Do you have kidney disease, or is there some reason for this severe osteoporosis that's been identified?
No, I don't have kidney disease. I do take little kidney pills from the acupuncturist.
No, but that wouldn't be it. You'd have to have fairly significant renal failure to develop osteoporosis. I'm wondering if you have a history of very heavy drinking or something?
No. I'm.
So you're kind of a mystery in terms of why you have your osteoporosis.
Well, I don't know why, but I do. My other question is, two parts, I guess. I'm thinking about taking strontium citrate, strontium
granulate, yeah. Well, granulate's not available in the United States, but the citrate is. And
okay.
We think that it probably would work. The granulate's just an amino acid chelate of strontium. So once it gets into the system, it should dissociate, and it's the strontium that gets into the bones. So granulate was a proprietary product in Europe that did the science to establish that their product worked. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of reasons you could piggyback on that science and say that it doesn't really matter what salt of strontium you use. That would probably be helpful. Other things that would be helpful would be vitamin K, vitamin D. Are you doing those as well?
Yes, I do. Vitamin D. I'm doing 5,000 milligrams a day of that on my doctor's recommendation of 5,000 milligrams.
Monitor your blood levels and don't let them get above 100. You probably won't get there on 5,000 a day. But I like that you're taking 5,000 a day and not 50,000 a week. I actually think 50,000 a week is probably bad, but that's just putting that out there to the rest of the audience. I think that probably may backfire, get the blood levels up, but actually disrupt bone formation. Anyway, the question you have is, what else is out there? And if you have severe osteoporosis and compression fractures, you're probably bad enough off that these very heavy pharmaceuticals are in fact appropriate for you. They're misused a lot. They're over prescribed, and they're given to people who have, normal bad scans but no fractures. That's inappropriate.
Uh-huh.
But you're in that bad situation where these drugs are, in fact, appropriate. I would say that your doctor's idea of doing the Forteo less frequently, that might make sense. It's certainly worth a try if you stretch it out, or reducing the dose, or both. Is your doctor monitoring your urine bone reuptake markers?
No.
Okay, you need to do that. And these are things called N-telopeptides. Your doctor will probably know about them, but has probably been told by some think tank somewhere that they're not useful. They are, because you can track whether you're being successful with your therapy.
That's called urine bone uptake levels?
Reuptake markers. These are proteins that are part of the brick and mortar that make up bone. If you are building bone, their levels in the urine will be low. If you are breaking bone down faster than you're building it, then they will be high. And so what you want to see is you want to see these drop as you do the therapy. And then that means that it's working.
Okay. Would you suggest taking a product called Bone Up? It has vitamin K in it.
I'm very familiar with it. Yes. And I think that it will help, but it's just substrate. It's just the basic building materials for bone. And at your situation, with already broken down bones, we need to kind of hijack the process and build bone, stimulate the growth of bone to prevent further fractures, because this could be very, very disabling if it persists. And obviously,
exactly.
It's quite painful.
Yeah, I've had this painful sciatica for about 6 weeks now. It's just very debilitating. I am from Santa Cruz, and that didn't make any difference, but I moved here, and I got this. Anyway, it's a long story, but I was just going to take strontium instead of the Fortio.
Well, you are, of course, free to do what you choose, but I don't think it's good enough for you.
Mm-hmm.
This is a situation. It's sort of like the person who comes in with an advanced cancer and wants to treat it with natural measures. And I look at the person and I say, really what we need to do is remove most of this cancer and maybe do some chemo and knock it back. That depends on the cancer, of course. And then, yes, support you with all of the natural measures in the world and all of the things that we can do that we know help. But when you've got a bad disease, you know, and this is a bad disease that you've got here, and it's advanced.
Yeah.
That's when you need to call in the big guns. And the big guns are good in these circumstances.
Okay,
so I keep working with your doctor. You may actually end up, you know, on Prolia because you're the person, you know, advanced osteoporosis with symptoms, compression fractures. You know, you're the person where the risk-benefit ratio for these agents starts to make sense.
Right. Would it be appropriate to take strontium in conjunction with the Fortio?
Yes, there's no problem with that.
Oh, good.
There isn't a problem with that. I think anybody who tells you that there's a problem, you should demand that they show you any data whatsoever, because okay. I don't think it exists.
So I'll have my doctor do a urine bone uptake
monitoring that. Yes. So you, as you play with your therapy, yeah, what you're looking for is to keep that low. So that means that you're building bone rather than breaking it down.
Okay. Okay. Real good.
Good luck to you.
Okay, Dr. Don, we'll keep up the good work.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the call. Bye bye.
You bet. Bye bye.
I'm going to go to this email from Tom in Albuquerque. Would you be so kind as to comment as to the veracity of this statement? Vancomycin is very specific for C. difficile and does not kill other bacteria. It seems to fly in the face of everything I remember hearing, especially the does not kill other bacteria part. I'm going to abbreviate the rest of Tom's letter here. Essentially, he's talking to regarding a mutual friend who is at the gastroenterology clinic at the University of New Mexico because he's having C. diff and he's had relapses of C. difficile. And they're talking about giving him a fecal transplant. And they've been treating him with oral vancomycin, which is the standard conventional treatment for C. difficile. And absolutely not true that vancomycin doesn't kill other bacteria. I think that it's a miscommunication because vancomycin, when taken orally, is not absorbed into the bloodstream. At least we don't think it is. Maybe in an extreme leaky gut, some might get through. But vancomycin is used intravenously all the time to treat sepsis, endocarditis, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. So it's completely inaccurate to say that it doesn't kill other bacteria. And it is not in the intestine selective for C. difficile. It does knock it down, and C. difficile is resistant to most other antibiotics. That's how it's the last bacteria left standing and is able to take over the intestinal niches. And the first time you get C. difficile, you have about a 70% chance of clearing it with vancomycin. The second time you get it, that ability to cure it goes down to less than 50%. If you have a third relapse, then your chances of clearing it are around 20%. And that's because it becomes selectively resistant to our drugs. We are an evolutionary pressure here. Saccharomyces boulardii is a yeast that seems to have very strong suppressive properties. And whenever I use clindamycin, which is the drug that is most likely to cause C. difficile, I always have people take 500 milligrams twice a day of Saccharomyces boulardii, which you can purchase at health food stores, and there is good scientific evidence that this is protective. So anybody out there who gets an MRSA infection and they're put on Clinda, which I try not to use, I'll tell you why in a moment, please take Espulardi and a good mixed probiotic to try and protect your intestine from the possibility of getting an overgrowth of C. difficile. At this conference at IFM recently, one of the researchers pointed out that we can see a footprint in the microbiome of people up to 3 years later. It's a very unique footprint. When you see this footprint, you can be sure that that person has taken clindamycin, because clindamycin has a persistent effect on the microflora in terms of changing the mix, changing the blend, and not, I might add, in a good way. About fecal transplant, which is now approved and being done for C. difficile, it is the only thing that it is approved for, although it probably also works for inflammatory bowel disease. That's still considered experimental. It is accepted for C. difficile. And of course, people at medical centers are overcomplicating it quite a bit and saying that you need a tissue match, the same kind of tissue match that you would need for an organ transplant. That's probably nonsense. It is, however, true that if you transplant fecal flora from a healthy sibling, you get the best take and the best variety and have the best chance of success. However, if you don't have a healthy parent or a healthy sibling, then I think a healthy donor of similar cultural background, not necessarily racial background, but just eating the same diet in childhood, is probably what you want come close. So hopefully that answers both Tom in Albuquerque's question and also throws some illumination on this topic, which dovetails quite nicely with my opening subject matter. Let's go now to John in Santa Cruz. Hello, John. Welcome to the program.
Hello. As you were talking about intestinal bacteria and things like that, are there any resources available where we can say we should eat this cooked food versus this raw food, and those kinds of bits of information, or breakdown of what nutrients are available cooked versus raw?
Yes.
So we can make...
Yeah, there are, but I don't know that there's a good compilation of all of this. I haven't found one that aggregates all of the information. But what I do when I'm trying to answer those questions is you have to do it kind of food by food. An example would be tomatoes. So there's a compound called lycopene in tomatoes that is much more bioavailable in cooked tomatoes than in raw tomatoes. So lycopene is associated with improved prostate health, and it's probably protective against prostate cancer. So you want cooked tomatoes for prostate health. With respect to apples, as I said, cooked apples are better for providing the compounds that promote gut health in terms of prebiotics. On the other hand, when we're talking about broccoli and kale and crucifers, it turns out that cooking destroys an enzyme called myrosinolate, and this enzyme is important to break down the crucifers into the substrate that the bacteria can then ferment to make the indole-3-carbinol that signals your immune system to calm down. So you see, it varies from food to food and from intention to intention. So it gets really, really complicated. And I don't know that anyone has aggregated it, but a really good approach is to go to Google Scholar and put something in like cooked tomatoes versus raw tomatoes nutrition, and you know, those, that sort of a keyword search will often turn up useful information.
What about the aspect of the temperature? If I make soup quite a bit, mm-hmm. and if it goes over the boiling point, it's just a completely different soup as if I keep it, let's say, at 140, 150 degrees. Mm-hmm.
And that's because when you boil things, you denature proteins, and you can taste you can taste those proteins. So you change the taste.
Go ahead.
You change the taste, and you also change the, you lose the enzymes that are present in raw vegetables. I was talking about how that seaweed contains, you know, bacteria with enzymes that help digest the seaweeds. It makes sense. I mean, the bacteria are growing on the seaweed because they're eating it. But vegetables in particular contain enzymes that help break down vegetables. And so when you cook them, you destroy those enzymes, which means your pancreas has to provide the enzymes to break down the cell walls. So the raw food people have a point to an extent about the fact that you get more content, more information in raw food. But not everyone can tolerate raw food. And certainly if you've already got a weak digestive system, it takes a lot of energy to bring that food up to room temp, up to body temperature, and break it down. And at least in the Chinese medicine tradition, when you're sick, you want the steamed vegetables that have been softened up a little bit in the first place, because that's easier to assimilate the basic nutrients. Although you obviously lose enzymes in the process.
Would that make a difference? You were talking about broccoli. If I cook my broccoli, or steam my broccoli, let's say get up to about 150 degrees, that would make it a completely different nutrient or other available substance than putting it and boiling it in water, wouldn't it?
I don't know. I think the temperature, the absolute temperature you reach is probably important, but I don't know what that number needs to be to preserve the enzymes. Obviously, we're talking about mechanical motion here, which goes up linearly with heat, and I just don't know how high it has to get before you shake that protein completely apart.
I know that when I eat raw apples, my ears itch. So I can't eat raw apples, so I'm going to try and cook, like you said, maybe a little cinnamon on them, too. But
yeah, try that. And it could be that you actually have antibodies circulating in your bloodstream to one component in apples. Obviously, there are hundreds of different potential antigens in apples, and it'll be an experiment to see whether or not it changes your reaction. But I certainly would encourage it.
And that's what it is. It's a constant experiment. I talk to people about these kinds of things, and I go, mark down what food makes you feel better, mark down what makes you feel worse, and there's your owner's manual.
To a certain extent, you can do that. I think one thing I often recommend to people is change your behavior. So when you go on an elimination diet, for example, if there are foods on the elimination diet that are allowed foods, but these are foods you've been eating every day for a long period of time, take those out too. And then when you reintroduce, so you go to complete novelty and lots of variety, and then you introduce back large volumes, you know, like on a test day, you'll eat a large volume of something you're wondering if it affects you and monitor the results. And you have to be have a little OCD or a notebook or a real commitment to do this, because you do end up spending a lot of time writing down what foods you're eating. I often suggest to people that they just take a photograph of their meals. And before they eat anything, take a photo with their phone. And then if they do have a reaction, they can go back and look at, you know, that day's date-stamped photos and maybe get a hint of what could have been the culprit. But, you know, it's complicated because the reactions can be delayed 2 or 3 days. And so if it's a delayed reaction, you may implicate the wrong food unless you're very, very cautious about how you do this. It's tricky, and you can't really do it on your own without some guidance.
Yeah, I guess the original question of nutrient availability, cooked versus raw and all that, I guess I just put it on myself to write the book.
Yeah, or do the blog or the website.
Do
the website.
Yeah.
I'm sure you could get some sponsors for it and get your time paid for. Essentially, I think we have to generate our own resources and share them. That's at this point, you know, no big company is going to do it for us, or if they do, their data is going to be suspect anyway.
Oh, sure it will. I appreciate your help so much. Thank you much.
Thank you much. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So here's a short article about vitamin D and Crohn's disease. There's emerging data that vitamin D supplementation may prolong remission in Crohn's disease. And the mechanism is not entirely established, but we do know that the vitamin D receptor, when it is fully saturated, is highly anti-inflammatory in the gut. This was a double-blind placebo study with a small N, 27 people with Crohn's disease, who were placed on either 2,000 units of vitamin D daily or placebo for 3 months. Those treated with supplementation were more likely to maintain their intestinal permeability, that is to say, low intestinal permeability. Increased permeability occurred in those who did not receive the vitamin D. Those with the highest blood levels had lower levels of inflammatory markers, which were the interleukins and C-reactive protein. And there was a statistically significant variation in whether or not they maintained their remission. So vitamin D, highly beneficial, highly recommended for people with Crohn's disease. And again, with any autoimmune disease, I encourage people to monitor blood levels and take a amount of vitamin D. I'd consider 2,000 quite conservative. Even the very conservative Institute of Medicine says that they couldn't find anything wrong with 4,000 units a day, even though they tried really hard. Get your blood level up above 40, above 50. I shoot for 70 in any kind of autoimmune disease. There's also strong evidence that this is a safe anti-cancer level. And vitamin D is a hormone. It's not a vitamin. It's been misunderstood. Vitamins are cofactors in chemical reactions. Vitamins are not hormones. This is a hormone, and it has profound effects on the immune system and on gut integrity. Going to Gail in Pacific Grove. Hello, Gail. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Your show's been just fascinating today.
Oh, thank you.
And right on topic, I'm having foot surgery soon, and I've been prescribed cefalexin. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes.
For 2 days, a total of 8 capsules afterwards, and I'm thinking prebiotics, probiotics, what do you suggest?
Well, for this indication, primarily probiotics. Cefalexin will take out a lot of your gut bacteria. It can cause C. diff. That is less likely than some of the other antibiotics I've mentioned, but that's the thing you really don't want. So a probiotic since you're taking this 4 times a day, that's the thing about cefalexin that's kind of annoying. You want to take your probiotic, if possible, away from not being in the stomach at the same time. So if you can manage it to at least 2 hours before or after the antibacterial, that would be useful. And
so it means never sleeping.
No, it means that you play around with the interval on the Keflex. So it's supposed to be every 4 hours. So that is how we usually tell people to take it, allowing you 8 hours to sleep and 16 hours essentially to be taking antibiotics. So let's suppose you take it first thing in the morning, 4 hours later, 4 hours later, 4 hours later. If you hit the mid mark, at least twice during the rest of the day, so that 2 hours after and 2 hours before you take your probiotics, it's a bit of a pain, but you only have to do it for 2 days. I would take the probiotics for about a week afterwards as well. Dose at least 50 billion per day, and you'll want to get 5,000 milligrams of S. boulardii in there just as well.
I have spell that, please?
Saccharomyces. I'm going to probably spell it wrong, but I'll be close. Saccharomyces boulardii, and I think that's wrong, but close. If you put that in a search engine, in a search engine, Google will correct my spelling for you.
The health food store will know too.
Absolutely, and about 500 a day on that one, also taken between the antibiotics, although that's less critical. What we're trying to do is, as I said, provide some ground cover, some mulch, if you will, to keep the bad bacteria from being able to just thrive like crazy. These probiotics will probably not persist for long in your body, but they'll persist for long enough to act as a a protective barrier, an umbrella, if you will. And then your good bacteria that are adapted for you will grow back up under that umbrella and sprout and take back over the niches and keep the bad guys out. It helps a lot. We do not have the perfect recipe. And during this time, as I've been talking about, as you're recovering from your antibiotics, lots of these prebiotic vegetables.
I'll be having steamed kale every
Yeah,
day.
And you know what? Jicama. Not steamed kale, raw kale. You want the kale raw, you want the apples cooked, and and try some jicama. Jicama okay. And kiwi are actually another couple of good ones. You could throw a kiwi, you could have some sliced kiwi with your breakfast, and you can have some jicama in a salad. And we don't know which one, and in fact, it's probably not one. It's probably a good broad mix that's going to get you the best variety. And
yes,
what we're learning is that the variety of the microbiome is what makes it so protective and adaptive. So
I'm so glad you go to those meetings and intensive learning experiences, because we benefit so much from your knowledge.
Thank you. I love this stuff, and you know it's real science, and it's what they do at the FM conventions that is so wonderful is that the researchers who can really bring you stuff you can use, and it's not just this esoteric thing in a journal. It's like, look, here's the mechanism. Here's why we mm-hmm. think this is good. Here's how to do it. And like I said, I've been telling people to take probiotics, and I came back saying, no, what we have to do is soil amendment. It's not planting the flowers in crappy soil, which is what I've been telling people to do. Well, that works as long as you keep planting them and take the probiotics every day. But what if we fix the soil so that they grow themselves and reseed like a healthy garden is supposed to?
I teach landscaping, and one of the things I always say to people, do a $200 hole for a 50-cent plant rather than the other way around.
Oh, I like that.
Everything's going to benefit.
I like that. Yeah, and then you get something that is self-sustaining.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really...
You put enough compost in there and it'll flourish, and everything else that grows around it will be healthier. It just works.
Yep, there you go. So prebiotics...
Can I ask you to repeat, please, 50 billion of what was the first thing you told me?
Okay, 50 billion mixed flora. I usually look for something that has... Bifidobacterium bifidus or Bifidobacterium infantilis.
Okay.
And then also you want to look for Lactobacillus GG, capital G, capital G, which is also called rhamnosus, Lactobacillus rhamnosus.
Okay.
And these are the ones that are, these are good ones. They have good science behind them. There are products out there that have them. And
is there a brand online that you could just...
Right. Yeah, sure. I'll just tell you what I use in my practice, okay? I use a company called Claire with a K. So it's K-L-A-I-R-E. And they make a good line of probiotic products. If you search that name, you will find their products. And they have one called Pro 5 that has 25 billion. It's a good mix. Good, you know, the science that they're using is 5 to 10 years old. So, but nobody has yet, that I know of, figured out how to grow the anaerobes, which are really where the action is. But what we do know is that these aerobic bacteria, the Lactobacillus and the Bifidobacterium, are among the first things that get into an infant that we can find.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in fact, and this is just fun fact, all right, in the mom's intestine, when she's pregnant, she has these dendritic cells, which are immune cells. They actually reach out, grab Bifidobacteria infantilis, absorb it, send it into the lymphatics, where it journeys into the lymphatics and goes to the breast via a pathway in the lymphatics to come out in the breast milk.
That's fascinating.
So when I said that we co-evolved with these bacteria, the fact that we have a mechanism to actively transport bacteria into breast milk gives me shivers.
It does.
And
the first time you put that baby to your breast, you know you're doing the right thing, too.
Imagine, you know, this is, not only do they get your DNA, but you give them your bacteria in the breast milk because they need it.
Wow, this is fascinating. Keep up the good work. Thank you so much for everything you do.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And I do want to throw out one thing. C-sections and intensive care unit babies, particularly if the mother gets antibiotics during pregnancy, that's going to have an effect on the bifidobacterium in the breast milk. So we need to start figuring out how to rehabilitate the imprinting of the neonate's bowel, because we should be getting a big gulp of lactobacillus as we go through the vagina and another big gulp of bifidobacterium in the breast milk. And if we're born by C-section, that doesn't happen. So we need to figure out a special formula for C-section babies. And we need to think twice about the trend for ever-increasing C-sections in this country, because it's not benign for the baby. And I take a history when I see a new patient. And if they had antibiotics, their mother had antibiotics during labor, or they had antibiotics as a neonate, spent any time in the ICU, or were born by C-section, I start out with the presumption that there may be something wrong with their microbiome and ask myself, what are they coming in with arthritis? Are they coming in with irritable bowel? Are they coming in with asthma? Is their presenting problem related to a microbiome problem that got started in infancy? And when you start thinking about things in a system-wide way, it's an Alice in Wonderland rabbit hole, but it really illuminates your understanding of health and disease. And like I said, that co-evolved organism that we are with our microbiota, we're really a planet. Each one of us is a planet with multiple ecologies, multiple climates, and all sorts of interactions going on. With an off-air question, when should I take probiotics? Well, you should take them on an empty stomach usually. And if you're going to take them with food, the food needs to be room temperature, nothing hotter than 100 degrees. That means no hot soups, no hot liquids, because you're going to potentially shut down some of those probiotics. So you want to take, they can be taken with food. But again, an empty stomach is probably better. Enteric coated probiotics are excellent. And let me put out a shout to fermented foods like sauerkraut, kefir, and yogurt. These are all really good sources of probiotics. And the prebiotics for those probiotics come along for the ride, which is also probably quite beneficial. Don't forget sauerkraut. It's a crucifer, so you're going to get that sulforaphane, which is so important for immune modulation and detoxification. Let's go to an anonymous caller. Anonymous caller on line two. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. What can I do for you?
I have a question about... I have an old injury. I was in a car accident when I was 17, and my leg hit the steering wheel column of the Volkswagen bus, and the inside of my leg's been affected ever since. I said late 50s. So I have some vein damage,
uh-huh.
And I lately have had a red spot on my shin that is itchy. It looks like a rash, and I've told that I may have lymphedema. And I wondered, is that normal?
No, I think lymphedema might be a misnomer for what you have, although you may be starting to develop it. Lymphedema is a condition where the lymphatics are injured. Typically, you see it after certain kinds of cancer therapy where the lymph nodes are removed, although it can...
Right, I understand. I've been reading up on
yeah.
that.
Yeah, and... The point is, it's a lymphatic issue. Now, it's often people will develop venous leakage. And what that does is that blood leaks out of the veins because the veins are, you have varicose veins, or the veins have been damaged, the valves get injured. So the veins don't, the veins essentially hold more fluid than they should. They can't get rid of the fluid when you're standing up. They can only get rid of the fluid when the vein is higher than the heart, so you need gravity flow to get rid of fluid. And so the fluid leaks out, which overloads the lymphatics, And so venous stasis, as it's called, looks a lot like lymphedema, but there are subtle differences. And if you do biopsies, what you see with lymphedema is that there's actually genetic differences in that tissue from venous stasis, and that this is fairly new data. So you probably have the venous stasis condition, and people can develop a dermatitis, or a kind of a rash. It's usually not just one spot, though, or a small spot. I mean, you're when you say a spot, I'm thinking about something that's maybe the size of a plum or smaller, rather than you know, the size of a piece of paper. And by the time venous stasis develops dermatitis, it's usually the size of a piece of paper, you know, big chunk of the front of the lower leg has a kind of raised, cobblestony, scaly, reddish discoloration, and that's what that looks like. You know, obviously, I can't diagnose things on the radio, but are you using support hose? Because that's
not yet.
Yeah, well, you're late. So you need to get support hose going, and especially when you exercise. And it's summer, and I know it's a pain, but if you put pressure on the tissue, then you squeeze the fluid back out of the lymphatics, and that will generally reverse any kind of stasis dermatitis.
Okay, great.
So good luck to you.
And thank you.
Give us a call back and let me know if the compression hose are helping.
Okay, neat. Yeah, I will. Thanks.
Thanks very much. I'm going to go to a quick email. This from Diane in the Bay Area. First of all, she wanted to talk mention Theramos. Theramos.com is a company that is trying to do, I think, for blood testing what 23andMe did for genetic testing, in that they're going to hand it over to the consumer. They will do blood spot tests for all sorts of standard laboratory testing, and they're cheap. They have in fact opened an office over in Palo Alto. They're working with Walgreens. I don't know what their market penetration. I don't think they have any market penetration on this side of the hill. This is one of those disruptive innovations that I'm watching to see what happens. If you want blood tests, you know, go get them. This is the other question Diane had was about an ultraviolet shoe zapper called the SteriShoe. Costs $125, and it's supposed to reduce the nail fungus spores in your shoes. A lot of us try to get rid of nail fungus. We get rid of it, and then it comes back in 6 months to a year. And the concept is, well, there's spores in your shoes, so let's zap the spores. I think this is wrongheaded. And I think it's a waste of money. The reason I say that is that what we want to do with recurrent toe fungus is work on your host. That's to say, you are vulnerable. So trying to sterilize your environment isn't really going to work because you're going to get re-exposed anyway. It's in your carpeting. It's in your sock drawer. It's in your mattress. The spores are not just in your shoes. So really what makes more sense is to make the environment of the toenail inhospitable using products like Nonyx, N-O-N-Y-X, or daily applications of tea tree oil or essential oils like lavender or oregano. I've even had patients tell me that Vicks Vapor Rub rubbed into the toes every day will prevent recurrence of toenail fungus. That's purely anecdotal, but the Nonyx certainly does have some good studies. And there's even a prescription product, costs $70 a bottle, called Penlac, that probably works about as well as anything else. Let's go to Kirkland in Santa Cruz. Hello, Kirkland.
Hi, Dr. Don.
Hi.
I wanted to say at the outset that I just love your show, and even though I'm sort of a science-based medicine person, I have a lot of respect for your approach. I really like it, so I'm one of your cheerleaders.
Thank you.
So, that being said, you just remarked on the toenail fungus. I just got rid of mine with using the that drug, whatever it was, for 9 months.
Probably Lamisil?
Yeah, Lamisil, yeah.
Yeah, terbinafine. Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful. Yeah, terbinafine, that's right.
Yeah, so. But in a year you might have it back if you don't do something to improve your host defense, because the reason you got it in the first place is that you have impaired host defense.
Mm-hmm. So I used to probably do, like, what I used to do, trying to get rid of it, put Vicks VapoRub on my toes and then put, you know, go to sleep with it at night with socks on.
You know what I would suggest is when you get out of the shower, take an emery board, rough up the surface of the nail and just put either tea tree oil or the Vicks Vapor Rub or that product, one of the Nonyx, N-O-N-Y-X is a good one. And these just will penetrate down into the nail a little bit, and it's simply, you know, mulch. It prevents the fungus from growing. It's an inhibitor. But if you inhibit it, it doesn't take root. It doesn't puff up the nail and create this little anthill environment for itself to grow in, and off we go.
Great. What I really wanted to talk to you about is I've got a friend who has ALS, and it's really sad watching him go downhill. But he's been taking for almost 2 years all this stuff, like $700-$800 a month from Dr. Joel Wallach. And I can't see any improvement. One, that, so I'm just wondering about two things. Is there anything to any of that stuff? The other thing is he's just been approached by another old friend of his who actually is talking about some hopeful breakthroughs towards ALS treatment in China, in Beijing. Do you know anything about either one of those?
All right. Well, in terms of the work that's being done in China, no, I'm not familiar with that. There are, there is groundbreaking work being done in the ALS world right now with small peptides that cross. That's like five or six amino acids long that cross the blood-brain barrier that seem to be neuroprotective. And in fact, I'm involved in one of those research projects myself. And I think that we're poised to actually figure out something we can do that will be fundamentally a game changer with Parkinson's disease and ALS. But, you know, the specific formula that's going to do it, I don't know what that is. With respect to Dr. Wallach, I know Dr. Wallach personally. He's flitted around in IFM circles. Plus, I had an interesting lunch with him once when during which he tried to recruit me to sell his products. I think he has a very successful net pyramided marketing establishment. I think his nutritional products are probably pretty good, but I think they're probably available elsewhere at a more economical price. So I'll leave it at that. And thanks very much for your call.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, we've come to the end of another hour. And I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. And I hope you'll be back to join me next week for more of Ask Dr. Dawn. So long and stay healthy.